Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent update to share with you. As you probably know, this podcast is made possible by the generous support of listeners like you. And with our financial year ending on June 30th, we're facing a $52,000 gap in funding that must be closed by that date. With just days to go, generous friends of the ministry have now offered to match every dollar given towards this goal up to $10,000. So take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley with you here on Unbelievable until 4 o'clock this afternoon. I do hope you're having a good weekend and that I can inject a little bit of interest into it as we, as usual, meet a Christian and a non-Christian on the programme today and they get discussing. Let me tell you what's coming up on the programme today.
You're unbelievable.
Well, we're going to be meeting, once again, Ed Turner. He's an atheist, and he got in touch with the programme a while back. We had him on a few weeks ago. He's back again to ask about, warfare and how much Christianity and religion in general is responsible for violent conflict around the world. He's going to be in discussion today with Mike Pierce, who's the author of a book called The Gods of War and also author of the bestseller Why the Rest Hates the West. And he's a Christian. He's going to be arguing that when it comes to violent conflict, it's secular states that have a lot more to answer for than Christianity. So that's our subject today. Violent conflict. How much is religion responsible for? So we look forward to meeting our guest today. And it's an important claim because a lot of the new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, etc., have painted religion in very broad brushstrokes, saying that it's the cause of many problems. Most wars have some kind of religious foundation. We're going to be looking into that as Ed takes that position and Mike opposes it. Now, speaking of Richard Dawkins, something very significant happened these last 2 weeks. A couple of things, in fact. Earlier on in the week, you may have heard about this bus campaign that Richard Dawkins is funding to put atheist slogans on the sides of buses along the lines of "there probably is no God, so get on with your life and enjoy it." It's provoked quite a lot of response in the media. And another important aspect of this is that Richard Dawkins was taking part in a debate earlier on in the week at Oxford University. It was between him and Professor John Lennox, a Christian professor at Oxford. And it was sponsored by the Fixed Point Foundation. And it was about whether science has disproved God. And I was there. I managed to witness the debate. It was an excellent time. And I also took many interviews during the course of the evening, both with people attending and with the main protagonists, Richard Dawkins and John Lennox. So we're going to be posting the audio from that. I'm going to be doing a special show next week at the same time between 2:30 and 4 o'clock. That's a review of that debate. I can't post the actual debate material because that's, as it were, copyrighted to the organisation who sponsored the debate, and you'll be able to get hold of a DVD of that. But I do have some really interesting interviews with Richard Dawkins and John Lennox to play you next week in full. So I do hope you'll go to that. Listen in when that goes out at 2:30 next Saturday. That's the 1st of November. And listen back online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. All I'm going to tell you now is that there's some very interesting admissions from Richard Dawkins that I managed to sort of get out of him when I had the chance to grill him. So do listen out for that and check back online, and you may hear more from other outlets as well. Okay, time to look back at some of the past 2 weeks of shows. I've had so much response to the last 2 weeks. I'm afraid I am not going to be able to play out all the phone messages and or read all the emails, but I'll try and give a fair smattering of them. 2 weeks ago, we had Michael Marsden on as our atheist. He was commenting on the Alpha Course, which he went on at Holy Trinity Brompton, and was in conversation with Pastor Nigel Desborough. He had many criticisms of it, and as it turned out, so did many Christians. Here's a couple of them.
Hi, my name is Avril Fyme, and I live in Strood in Kent. My daughter went on an Alpha Course, and there were just two of them on it, and unfortunately there was not enough follow-up from it, which I think is one of the main criticisms would be you must be careful that you have lots of follow-up, because the scripture says, you know, that when you empty yourself and you do not, you're emptied and you are not filled with the Holy Spirit, you know, there is not follow-up to with new Christians, then it's worse than it was before. And I would have said that in the circumstances that we have had, that that has actually been the case. And so that is really the only thing I'd like to see. Thank you. Bye.
Hello, my name is Doreen Harris. I come from West Wales. As regards the Alpha, I've been to two with people, taken people, and I've got to be honest, I've never, ever, ever been impressed by it. I think the last Alpha course, the last church I went to, I took friends, and my friend had already come to the Lord through a witness with me. We'd prayed together, and she'd asked to come to the Lord after being an atheist for about 14 years. And when she went to the Alpha course, which I thought would help her understand, she said she felt it was utter waste of time. They all talk very posh on the film, not like us ordinary people. They all seemed a very posh sort of selected type of people on the film. So she couldn't sort of feel at home with that. Two other people came to the Lord supposedly after the course, but they were very fond of their stomach. And I think they, as they said afterwards, they went originally for the meals, because the meals were beautiful. But they have come to the Lord since. They've both been baptized, and I'll be honest with you, they're not very spiritual. Thank you anyway. We're really enjoying this afternoon talk. And I will pray for all these atheist people that come on our program. The Holy Spirit will enlighten them.
Well, there you go. Sort of obviously criticisms of a different nature to Michael's, but nonetheless, obviously the Alpha course doesn't appeal to all Christians. But that was obviously something we said at the time anyway, that it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but obviously it has been the route to faith for many people. Here's some people who had actual questions for Michael, our atheist, on the programme about the Alpha course.
Hello, my name's Tanya. It's sort of like reasoning in a roundabout way, but this is about faith, and I think it is quite possible, because God takes the foolish things to confound the wise, that he's engaging at such a high intellectual level, and the scriptures are to be received as if we were children. There is an issue for him to do with faith. He thinks that Christians may, you know, be double-minded, or I'm not sure what language to use, something about lying to ourselves. I'm a Christian. It's not about that. It's really about daring to believe, just daring to believe, to taste and to see whether or not you actually find this to be true, but coming from the standpoint of wanting to believe. Thank you. I hope that makes sense, actually.
My name is Tony Wernham. I became a Christian in 1983, but in 1984, I had a major operation and I was paralyzed from the spine. And after 3 days of intensive prayer, when my church knew about it, that was 6 days later, a toe moved, and later I was told that the hospital had thought, the doctors, that I would never walk again, and they were going to tell the other patients. The second time was the other kidney developed a growth. My two Christian friends, and they laid hands on me and we prayed, and on the Tuesday I was taken in. On the Wednesday before the operation, they found that the growth in the kidney had gone completely and not passed through any toilet function. That's why I just want to witness for my twice healing, and most important healing is I've been forgiven by God.
Well, thank you very much for those comments. They'll be passed along to Michael in due course, and to Nigel Desborough, our pastor on that programme. If you want to listen back to that interaction between them about the Alpha course and how valuable it is, and whether atheists are really going to be convinced by the arguments on the Alpha course, and some very interesting discussion on the Holy Spirit aspect of it, do visit the webpage of Unbelievable. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Quickly, some emails on this. Lucia says, I'm listening to the program on the Alpha course. I was raised a Roman Catholic and went through all the ritual stuff of being christened, etc., communion and confirmation, then drifted away, only to come back in my late teens. I was searching, and a friend of mine introduced me to the Alpha course in 1996. I had the most amazing experience of the Holy Spirit. It was hard not to feel overwhelmed. The tears just kept on coming. I was on a real high. My personal relationship with my Lord and Saviour commenced over the years. He has revealed himself to me so many times. I am truly blessed. I have no doubt ever that the Alpha course is a fix. I have since helped on Alpha and brought many people to Alpha, including my husband, who was raised an Anglican. Thank you, Lucia. So when you say the Alpha course is a fix, you mean it's a spiritual high that fixes you, I suppose. Norma from Silverfish Jewellery says, listen to the programme today. I feel sorry for your atheist who's never experienced Christ. Has he ever read the Bible? I suggest he start at Matthew. And has he ever prayed and asked Jesus to come into his life and reveal himself to him? I know you recommended he read some other books, but I say start with the Bible. It really is alive, the living word of God. I was brought up in Sunday school and left as a teenager, then came back to God when one sleepless night 13 years ago, I picked up the Bible and God showed up right there in my room and started speaking to me. I recommend it to everyone. Keep it up. Love listening to your show while I'm in my workshop. Shout out to the staff at Silverfish Jewellery. Well, a big shout out to those guys there. Thank you very much for emailing me, Norma. Mike in Cheshire, just got time to squeeze yours in. I'm of the opinion that intellectual credibility is a stumbling point for atheists, not on the grounds that one religion needs to be accepted over the others or that validity needs to be assumed in one religious text and disregarded in all others, but simply at the fundamental level that to approach any faith requires one to accept the possibility of the supernatural. To the atheist who understands the reality of existence to be entirely revealed in the natural world, this first step, if it is to be merely a presumption or proposition, seems too huge an intellectual chasm to cross. As Christians, we recognize that there is an inherent knowledge of the existence of God within all of us, even within the atheist who so adamantly deny his existence. Those who would be deemed seekers, who would attend an Alpha course looking for God, and in doing so utterly defy the understanding of their atheist friends, who know them to be rational, intelligent people, merely possess the same understanding as the atheist, but on a sub or semi-conscious level. Thank you very much, Mike. If you want to email, I'll be giving out the address and the number to call if you want to leave a voicemail message later on in the programme. But that was 2 weeks ago. Last week, we had Norman Hanson, former Christian, debating faith and Jesus Christ with Amy Orr Ewing of the Ravi Zacharias Trust. Here's some of your comments on that particular interaction.
Hi. This woman, Amy, is just having a go at the atheist guy because he can't prove that God doesn't exist. And apparently, him having certainty that God doesn't exist is not allowed. However, it is allowed that she has certainty that there is a man in the sky. Okay? So, no, Amy, be quiet.
Hello, my name's Jill Husky. Yeah, my question is, I'd just like the respondent to say if there's any experiences that he had when he was a Christian, which at the time he was sure that it was the existence of God, and how does he explain those now? I mean, as a Christian myself, I've had experiences of the love of God, which are really powerful, and I can't really say why that should have happened in that particular setting, except that I was worshipping, and, you know, I've known people be healed from tumours, I've known drug addicts who have been able to stay off the drugs when they said they know they wouldn't have managed to do it normally because they've been prayed for. And I'm sure with all his experience of ministry, that gentleman must have had experiences like that if he was really a Christian. How does he explain them now?
Hello, Justin. Brilliant program, really interesting. My name is Elizabeth. Yeah, I'm interested about what this chap is saying, who was a Christian. I'd like to ask him the question, if I was there, I'd say, what does he get out of his change of view? What's the payoff that he gets from living out of the beliefs he has now as opposed to his beliefs when he felt that he was a Christian?
Hello, my name's Jacqueline Sabula. A Christian's talking in a non-Christian who used to be a Christian and now is a scientist. Would you please ask him just to look at Laminin, L-A-M-I-N-I-N, and if you look at it under a microscope, you will see Jesus on the cross. You know, no one can can say that God couldn't prove something like that, because a scientist would not be able to tell you about it. Anyway, it's Laminin, L-A-M-I-N-I-N.
Well, thank you for those phone messages. And the Laminin one, yeah, I looked into that on the internet. It's quite interesting. I might pursue that in the future. But thank you for alerting me to that one. No time for emails. We're out of time, I'm afraid. But I'll try and read some of them next week. Do check out, again, the Unbelievable webpage if you did miss that programme of last week that people were responding to there. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And you can hear that discussion between Norman Hanson, former Christian, now an atheist, and Amy Orr Ewing of the Ravi Zacharias Trust. Okay, we're going to be meeting our guests shortly. They are Ed Turner, an atheist, and Mike Pierce, who is a Christian and a historian. And we're going to be talking about violent conflict and just how much Christianity is responsible for it. So that's to come. And on a not dissimilar subject, here's John Twistleton answering another difficult question.
Frequently Asked Questions with John Twistleton.
If God is so good, how do you explain all the wickedness in the world? Doesn't God care? For Christians, it's the FAQ above all FAQs, the most frequently asked question we get. Deep down, people want to believe there's a good God. When they encounter horrid things and horrid people, that faith crumbles. To believe in a good God in the face of all the wickedness in the world seems either harsh or soft-minded, depending on people's stance. The best approach to this question is to tell a powerful story. For example, you can't explain the wickedness behind Auschwitz, but you need to hear about Maximilian Kolbe. This priest sheltered some 2,000 Jews from the wickedness of the Nazis in his Polish friary, to be finally arrested by the German Gestapo and be sent himself to Auschwitz. A man from Kolbe's barracks vanished in the summer of 1941. The camp commandant ordered that 10 men be chosen from the same barracks to be starved to death, so as to deter further escape attempts. As these men were selected, one of them cried out, lamenting the family he'd leave behind. Kolbe, a celibate priest, volunteered to take his place. In the starvation cell, Father Maximilian led the men in songs of praise to God. After 3 weeks, only Kolbe and three others were still alive. We're told by witnesses that Kolbe's death was heroic. Each time the guards checked on him, he was calmly standing or kneeling in the middle of the cell, while the others lay moaning or complaining around him. In the end, they murdered him by injecting him with carbolic acid. Those present at the injection say he raised his left arm to welcome his death, just as Christ welcomed his cross. I can't explain Auschwitz, but I can point to God being there in Maximilian Kolbe. We can't explain the wickedness in the world, but we can point to God's goodness in the midst of it. If God were less good, he'd have made us puppets, lacking freedom to love. Because he's made us free, we're capable of both great good and great evil. The world God made produced both Maximilian Kolbe and Adolf Hitler. Both were also baptized Christians. One lived out his baptism as a man of God, the other forsook his baptism to build his own kingdom, the ill-fated Third Reich. So much misery in the world traces back to how people use the freedom they've been given. When, as in the case of Hitler, they make bad choices, the whole world can end up feeling the consequences. If you condemn the Creator for the wickedness in the world, you're condemning him for granting human beings the freedom to mess up. 70% of all website hits worldwide are to pornographic sites. Would you use that as an excuse to condemn the internet when it hosts so many valuable social networks, when it generates so much creativity through the sharing of ideas? You've got to take the rough with the smooth, and that's a truth that goes right into the heart of God. The cross of Jesus shows what wickedness does to God. Can you look at the cross and say he doesn't care about it? In Christian faith, we have a God who suffers along with us and comforts us in our weakness. God uses our suffering, as he did even in Auschwitz, to help us comfort and help one another in the face of evil. God can take our pain and suffering and turn it round for good. The story of Joseph in the first book of the Bible is a roller coaster of a story. In the last chapter of the book of Genesis, Joseph forgives his brothers, who'd tried to murder him out of jealousy. Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people, Joseph says, referring to his stewardship in Egypt, which his brothers made happen, and which saved the land from the consequences of famine. If God is so good, how do you explain all the wickedness in the world? Doesn't God care? There's no perfect explanation of wickedness, but there's abundant testimony to a God who helps his people live through it and rise above it. More than that, in the ultimate picture, wickedness will receive its comeuppance only if there's a God to give it.
If you have any difficult questions about the Christian faith or have your own answer for the frequently asked question we looked at today, please visit www.premier.org.uk/FAQ.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, welcome along to the programme, and it's great to have you with us. And two special guests joining me for the programme today as we talk about violent conflict and is religion bad for the world. It's something I think has been a source of contention of late, particularly certain new atheists, as they've come to be called, putting this about, if you like, Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion, Christopher Hitchens and others, putting it across this idea that we'd be better off without religion because it causes more harm than good in the world, especially when it comes to the violent conflict that many see it as being responsible for. Well, we're going to be looking into this subject today. We've got with us in the studio here, Ed Turner. If you're a regular listener to Unbelievable, you may remember Ed was with us a few weeks back debating Andy Bannister of the London School of Theology on, we called it putting Christianity on trial, and we had a couple of really interesting programmes with them both with me in the studio. Well, Ed's game for this kind of thing and has made himself available to come back in, and so it's great to have Ed back with us again. We're also going to be meeting for the first time on this programme, Mike Pierce, and he is the author of The Gods of War, and very relevant to our topic today. Its subtitle is Religion the Primary Cause of Violent Conflict? Mike is our Christian on the programme today, and he's going to be making the case that actually the case, if you like, for religion causing war has been somewhat overstated, and that in fact, in his opinion, irreligion has produced far more conflict and bloodier wars than religion has over the years. We'll be finding out more about that as we go. Mike is the Professor of History at Houghton College in New York, and also Visiting Professor of Church History at the Evangelical Theological Seminary in Osijek, Croatia. Am I pronouncing that correctly there?
Houghton and Osijek.
Okay. Glad you're there to correct my awful pronunciation. So, Mike, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today. Give us, in a nutshell, kind of your background, because you actually have been in the UK a long time before you sort of started working abroad.
Well, yes, I'm a Briton. I lived there until 2004. For a number of years, taught church history and a few other subjects at London School of Theology, and led the degree program in theology there, and have been teaching for the past 10 years or so, just purely part-time as a visiting professor in the seminary in Osijek in Croatia, as you mentioned. And then four years ago, a little bit more, crossed over the Atlantic and started teaching in the history department in Houghton College, which is in rural western New York. It's way, way outside the city.
Right. We're not talking Manhattan here.
We're talking about somewhere. It's not quite the middle of nowhere, but you can see it from where we are.
Sure. I mean, you had a very influential book come out a few years ago called Why the Rest Hates the West. That yes. Received a lot of attention at the time. Obviously, you know, very much.
Yes, this latest one isn't holding a candle to that so far, but that's okay.
but I mean, obviously there is a lot of interest in why that, you know, things like September the 11th happened. You know, what yeah. is it about what the West represents that so many people seem to have a problem with? Yeah. And in a way, is this new book a kind of, is it a, has it come out of that kind of what you were doing in your first book?
It's one of two intended sequels to Why the Rest. And of course, the difficulty always with writing a sequel is that you're kind of presupposing constantly all of the rather intricate arguments you made in your initial, more well-known book. Mm. And of course, you can't possibly assume that the reader has read that.
Yeah.
And therefore, you're having to find other ways of saying it, and in jolly short order as well, so you don't bore those who did read it without confusing those who didn't.
Sure. Well, in any case, we'll look at some of the things that you're suggesting in the book, and with Ed to, you know, with his atheist hat on, as it were, to look at that as well. Ed Turner is with me. If you didn't manage to catch the programmes that he contributed to with Andy Bannister a few weeks ago, and then do check out the Unbelievable podcast, the back catalogue of archive programmes at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Some really interesting programmes there. And Ed, thanks for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Now, you're sort of a barrister, training as
solicitor.
Training as a solicitor. Yeah. I never get it right.
Barristers wear the silly wigs and the black gowns and speak in court. Solicitors do the donkey work in the office.
Okay. Well, in any case, it's great to have you back. And you got in touch with us originally to say you'd love to sort of, you know, have some Christian atheist sort of discussions, and so it's a delight to have you back again.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. You seem to be the only ones who'll have me. I've been emailing other Christian organisations, churches, radio stations, and you seem to be the only one in the country who's doing actually does a skeptics debate show. So hats off to you for that.
Well, thank you very much. We occupy a small, but we like to think, you know.
Well, I think it's an important job.
Important niche.
Yeah.
So thank you for being my guest again. You're obviously approaching this with the view that, in common perhaps with those atheists I mentioned earlier on, that religion is basically bad for the world because of the violent conflict that it has caused.
Well, I mean, this is a very complex area, and I need to set out my stall carefully before I'm attacked for views that I don't hold. Basically, wars are... wars that were fought centuries ago. The causes are still being hotly debated today. Let me get this straight right now. I'd never argue that religion is the only cause of world conflict, and it may not even be the biggest source. At the end of the day, the primary reason why men go to war is for our boneheaded stupidity and our greed. So you'd probably have to go back to the Crusades or to the Reformation or the reign of Bloody Mary to actually... get a conflict where people were literally fighting over what the Holy Scriptures said. But religion today is still a very important cause, or it's a catalyst. It's very divisive, and people seem to play it down. They don't want to criticise religion. They don't.
And I mean, I know that when he's been asked why, for instance, Richard Dawkins has gone on this tack of attacking religion, in a very outspoken way, he said it was September the 11th, 2001, that was a turning point for him where he decided that he had to debunk religion because of the bad effects it has, if you like.
Yeah, well, as it was for many people. I think maybe Christianity is causing problems in other areas, but I don't think it's the religion that's causing the most global conflict. I think that is definitely Islam. And that was shown on September the 11th when, the 19 hijackers destroyed the World Trade Center and the Pentagon by flying aeroplanes into them. And there was an explicitly religious motive to that.
Well, we'll look into that as well with Mike as we go on in the show today. Those are our guests, though, joining me today. Ed Turner, our atheist on the programme today, and Mike Pierce, our Christian, as we ask, violent conflict, is religion bad for the world? We'll be back in just a moment here on Unbelievable.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that this podcast is made possible by the generosity of friends like you. And right now, we're facing a $52,000 funding gap that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June 30th. Generous friends of this ministry have offered to match every dollar given up to $10,000, so I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now. Your gift will help keep important conversations like this one coming to listeners like you. Closing this gap in full by June 30th is vital, so please give your best gift now, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back, and we're looking today at violent conflict and is religion bad for the world? With me in the studio is Ed Turner, who's our atheist protagonist on the show today. Mike Pierce joins us on the phone from Australia, believe it or not. Thanks to Mike for making himself available from long distance for this. Mike is the author of The Gods of War. It's a book that asks whether religion is the primary cause of violent conflict, as some have been saying of late, and it's available through the Premier Shop, as most good books are, published by InterVarsity Press. If you want to get it through the Premier website, that's premier.org.uk/shop. So we're asking the question today, is religion bad for the world in this way? Ed, in a sense, you were the person who came to me saying, I think this would be a good topic for discussion.
Yeah.
I mean, now you've actually read Mike's book since we sort had that
right
first.
Now, yeah.
Did that sort of change your initial perceptions at all, just reading the book, about the role of religion in war and that sort of thing?
Well, basically, I was actually surprised by how much I agreed with it. I was expecting it to be an evangelical apologetics piece and trying to play down religion, but actually there is a lot of what I agree in there, and I think it's a good book, and I would recommend people read it. I think it's a very balanced overview of global conflicts. So I actually agreed with about 75% of it. It's not, it didn't fall into the, you know, to the usual, you know, traps of, well, okay, the Crusades and the Inquisition killed so many people, but look at Hitler and Stalin, look what they did. You know, there was nothing like that. And you actually, we agree that, you know, Stalinist communism and Nazism were, you know, religions in themselves. But again, I mean, there were certain things that, it's not so much what, you know, you did talk about is what you didn't talk about. You know, you didn't talk about the motives of the, you know, the 9/11 hijackers. You know, you didn't, it sort of skirted over the Inquisition and, you know, the anti-Jewish pogroms, for example. But like I say, a lot of in there that I did agree with. So basically my main truck with the book, because obviously we're here to have a debate and I've got to start a fight somehow, is that I didn't actually get a central argument from the book as to why religion is good. You seem to be saying, well, this conflict would happen anyway. I mean, religion makes a very bold claim that it leads to, you know, happy and fulfilled life and peace and all that. And I didn't really get from the book a really positive defence of religion in general or Christianity in particular.
What do you say to that, Mike?
Well, apart from those last couple of remarks that the book is somehow kind of a little bit ineffectual, I was getting extremely worried with what Ed was saying earlier on, because I thought this is getting off a catastrophic start. There's not nearly enough to fight about. although he did say earlier on that he was sure I was going to attack him for views he didn't hold. I don't know how he was.
Well, I mean, I just don't want you to think that I think religion is the only cause of human conflict. I mean, without religion, human beings would find plenty else to fight about.
I just wonder whether an assumption that Christians do that kind of thing was lying behind.
You'd be surprised.
yeah, I would.
What do you reckon then, Mike? I mean, you're writing this book presumably somewhat as a reply to people like Christopher Hitchens, whose book, God is Not Great, Why Religion Poisons Everything. Sort of, he makes various, you know, polemical statements about the way in which religion has been responsible for all kinds of war and seems to ignore any kind of perhaps blame that might be pointed at secular regimes that have been.
Yes, I mean, I didn't agree with, and I realise this is perhaps becoming quite a contentious area in the past couple of years. I didn't agree with what Ed said in his claim that Nazism and communism were religions. There's a couple of very influential writers, as some listeners might well know at the moment, looking at those terrible regimes as connected with religion. There's Michael Burley, who himself is a Christian, I understand, who's considering them as kind of political religions, and John Gray, who is himself an atheist, who's looking at how those creeds have taken bits of their Christian heritage, even as they vociferously reject Christianity. Now, I accept both of their points, but it's kind of beside the point in this discussion, because there's going to have to be some kind of framework of meaning for public life, either atheistic, as those terrible regimes, or religious.
Okay, I mean, your suggestion then, Ed, is that these atheistic regimes are, you know, tantamount to religious in some way, and therefore don't come under your banner of what constitutes atheism, which presumably is some kind of rational free thought kind of...
Well, first of all, the point about fascism and Nazism, there was nothing secular or atheistic about it. I'm glad you mentioned Michael Burley, actually. I've read his book recently, Sacred Causes, and he mounts a rather lumpen and dishonest defence of the Vatican in the 1930s and throughout the Second World War. It was G.K. Chesterton at the time who said, when men don't believe in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. Chesterton was a Roman Catholic. He was actually a very vocal supporter of General Franco's fascist regime in Spain. And incidentally, the last war that the Catholic Church declared as a just war that I know about was General Franco's invasion of Republican Spain on the side of Hitler with Muslim mercenaries.
Hang on.
So I'm just saying there was nothing...
Invasion of Spain. Well, it's Spain's own military coming in from outside in North Africa. On the side of Hitler, the Second World War hadn't even started. This is 1936.
Yeah.
And the Muslims were not mercenaries. They were Spanish subjects from Morocco. But other than that, did on, yes.
Okay.
I'm not aware that, by the way, in fact, I rather doubt that this was declared to be a just war. The Catholic Church was cautious through this conflict as well. Local Catholics certainly did back Franco, who was by no means a religious man, by the way, largely because Republicans in the immediately preceding period had been massacring rather a lot of priests and nuns.
Yeah, I accept that there were persecutions of the church carried out by fascist and Nazi regimes, but basically it was because they were opposed to them. It wasn't, you know, an expressly, right, we've got to wipe out the church. The cooperation of the Vatican under Pius the 11th and Pius the 12th is quite well documented. Basically, you know, the Concordat signed in 1933. Again, it's quite controversial as to whether the Catholic Church was forced into it or whether they... I personally think it was something that they wanted for a long time, and they gained a lot of benefits from it. And basically, when Pius the 12th was, was quite openly supportive of Hitler's regime. I mean, he 4 days after his coronation in 1939, he drafted a rather sycophantic greeting to the address to the most illustrious Adolf Hitler, Herr Adolf Hitler, and ordered that prayers be said on Hitler's birthday throughout the Reich. And also, about 25% of the Waffen SS were confessing Catholics. None of them that I know.
That's a lower proportion than in the German population as a whole, obviously, because the German population at the time of the Hitler regime was
it's about two thirds Protestant,
35% Catholic.
Yeah,
but I mean, the thing is, you can take the sort of cultural religious backgrounds of anybody throughout, well, certainly say throughout European history. Let's stay with the Christianity for a moment, and say, well, this person came from a Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Protestant background, and therefore the terrible things that they did was because of that background. Now, I'm not speaking up on behalf of the Catholic Church. I'm not myself a Catholic, but an evangelical. But it has to be admitted that Catholics generally, whether merely culturally so or genuinely committed and devoutly so, had a lot better record than most other Germans in resisting aspects of Hitler's regime.
Right. Well, that may be true for individual Catholics, but what I was saying is none of the Waffen SS are actually excommunicated for taking part in the Final Solution. Yeah. No Nazi leader. A lot of the Nazi leaders were Catholics. None of them was ever excommunicated for the Final Solution. Joseph Goebbels was the only one who was excommunicated, but that was before the end of the Second World War, and that's because he married a Protestant. So I think that does seem
the record of all of the churches, including the Catholic Church, through the Second World War, is rather tawdry. But I think that of the Catholic Church actually rather better. And of course, this argument, particularly about the record of Pius XII and those around him, goes on and on. I simply want to point out that this did not really become a debate at all until the until about 1960, when that play was published by that fellow.
Yeah, the deputy.
I'm trying to remember the details. It's about 1960.
Yeah. I think it's Rudolf Hulse.
The reflections that have been made about Pius at all publicly, including by Jewish spokesmen, were those of praise for his work in rescuing as many people as possible. Mm. Now, it's not that more evidence has come to light since then, though obviously, of course, in the course of time it has. But public opinion about the nature of that record has changed, and things for which he was not considered blameworthy at the time or afterwards, because he's, as many Catholics will say today, his position was absolutely impossible. He did simply what he could. Had he done more, he would have made the situation worse.
I don't agree with that.
Accepted until that front is kind of opened up by secularists, communists and other secularists, from around 1960 or so, and of course it's ground on ever since. I mean, I go into this debate in quite a bit in a number of my classes, not just in respect of Pius, but in a similar sort of micro argument of the same kind in Balkan history with Cardinal Stepinac in Zagreb, and really the conclusion on both sides is the same. These guys could possibly have done better. They were in impossible situations. Their motivation is far from lily-white, but frankly, they don't stink as badly as do the motives of their accusers, which were generally communists during the Cold War period, whose real purpose was to discredit Catholicism. And I mean, that's reflected, including in some of the writers who...
Well, I mean, just to sort of wrap it up on Pius, because I don't want to stick with this for the whole debate. I mean, my point... I know Pius gets a very bad press. I mean, my point about Eugenio Pacelli is that he acted like a politician. He did not act like a man who, you know, had a hotline to the big guy in the sky, who's Christ's vicar on earth. I know he was in an impossible situation. One figure I've heard is that he rescued 500,000 Jews...
That sounds inflated to me.
Well, I mean, that's like I say, that's a generous figure. I'm glad you go. maybe it's lower, but I'm prepared to accept that was true. But he never formally spoke out, and you've got to wonder, well, what if he had spoken out? What if he'd had, denounced Nazism from the beginning? There's plenty of blame to go around as to what happened in the Second World War.
I suspect that his calculations were correct. That he wouldn't have saved a single Jew, maybe lost many of those that, under the circumstances, were hidden, and in the process lost a load of other people as well, including any further freedom for his own action. Now, I mean, you point there about he acted like a politician. I accept entirely, and this is why I'm neither a Catholic nor do I subscribe to any of the other territorial churches, because that's the trap that they've all fallen into repeatedly through history. I spell this out in the book, but you're familiar with this already.
Yes.
The attempt to have a Christian state simply creates certain kinds of churches and institutions that act politically because they have to, because you can't run a state any other way.
I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, are many of your reservations about the role of churches and their role in violence, etc., to do with perhaps the history of the Catholic Church over the years, Ed? You mentioned the Inquisition and things like that, where they have acted in this kind of... you know, sort of as a state almost, you know, in this political way.
Yeah.
And Mike, I assume for you that this is where the church has got it wrong over the years, but it's not, it's relatively small in the eyes of the whole of scope of history. I don't know. I mean, Eddie's...
Well, I'll let it go first.
The Catholic Church does make itself a very soft target on occasions. I mean, part of my sort of complaint about religion is that it claims to make people act morally, whereas I don't think it does. I don't think it adds anything more to ordinary innate human decency and morality. And also that it actually distorts and perverts it. It makes a bad situation worse. And I think the behaviour of the Catholic Church throughout, you know, the 30s and 40s is graphically demonstrates this. But I just object. My final point is I object when people describe fascism and Nazism as secular. There was nothing secular or atheistic about them.
Do you? I mean, I think it would be good to touch on this. you do believe that you have to be able to talk about these regimes as atheistic, Mike. Is that the case?
Well, in nearly every case, I mean, I'm afraid it is just simply flat wrong. Even in respect of the Falangists in Spain, where there's a strong element of religious support, that is support for, which is morally reprehensible. I accept that fully. But the leadership from the top is not motivated by religion, neither Franco personally nor his immediate circle. They're merely willing to play along with this.
But is there behaviour?
Fascist movements, whether in France, the fascist movements around France between the two world wars, or Hitler's Nazism, or Mussolini's fascism, are explicitly secular. The only cases where his argument would hold up to some extent would be in Romania and the Iron Guard movement, and the Ustasha, even then, only to an extent, in Croatia during World War II.
Why do you claim then, Ed, that these regimes are not atheistic, are not secular?
Well, Hitler constantly... I accept that maybe they weren't on an explicit crusade defending the scriptures, but there was an explicitly religious element to, you know, to Hitler's rantings. I mean, he constantly invoked Christ in his speeches. He said that he was carrying out the solution to the Jewish question in completing what Christ couldn't do. Now, there seems to be a bit of debate over whether Hitler was an atheist or not. I don't think there's any mileage in discussing that. Probably Hitler himself didn't know. They weren't motivated by religion, but they were using the religious belief and the scriptures to carry out the horrific acts. And
so religion was being used.
Religion was being used as a motivating tool, and it was Napoleon Bonaparte that said religion is very useful stuff for keeping the little people quiet.
Mike,
I think in a sense, I mean, I agree with what you've just said, although I think you've talked yourself out of your original proposition there. And of course, that it makes it all the more necessary for religious people to insist on defining what religion is, rather than have secularists, whether those who claim to be their friends or those who are explicitly their enemies, define it for them and then rubbish it. The fact that it was occasionally used, I accept fully. I mean, that's quite obvious from the evidence in the Second World War and the fascist regimes that preceded them or went on during them. But that the Nazis themselves, just to take the most eye-catching example, were devout, you know, is a nonsensical idea. They were explicitly atheistic, and all of their correspondence between themselves makes it quite plain that they see the church as one of their principal enemies that needs to be humoured in the interests of being stifled in the medium to longer term.
Do you remember what the German soldiers had?
Of course.
Do you remember what the German soldiers had inscribed on their belt buckles, Mike?
No, I'm sorry.
It was Gott mit uns, God is with us.
Yeah.
I accept that there were persecutions.
Was that a Nazi innovation, or was that something that had been there all along, including during World Wars, countries tend to do?
I think that was a Nazi innovation.
The fact is, what you're saying, Mike, is that religion was used as a kind of a tool in the armory of the Nazi regime but the motivation for what they were doing was not religious, it was explicitly secular and atheist.
Well, and the Nazis themselves were quite clear about that in their own minds, as their own internal correspondence shows, yes.
So is your contention then, Ed, that religion is evil because it's a motivating force for violence, or is it simply that occasionally, religion gets used as a bit of a prop for violence, which actually could originate from entirely different kind of motivations? Because there's a difference between those two, isn't there?
Well, I think it's somewhere in between. It's used as a prop. It just seems to be sort of self-perpetuating. I mean, once you tell people that you have the backing of the creator of the universe, then you can get them to do anything.
This is the trouble, isn't it? Why religion is so easy to misuse in this fashion and has been repeatedly through history, and surely this is something on which we can both agree, that religion, if one can't take its claims at all seriously, trumps every other form of moral consideration. So that as soon
exactly,
as any
parties,
whether individuals or factions within a state or states between themselves start to fall out, then it's likely to be resorted to show why I am right and you are wrong.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You're in trouble.
Yeah, but I mean, again, you're sort of using secularism and atheism as though they are core ideologies and terms when they're not. I mean, atheism has the word atheist has no content to it at all. It simply means that you don't...
It's a negation, yes.
Yes, it's a negation. Secularism, you know, as far as I'm concerned, means separation between church and state. Okay, so in that respect, it's possible, you know, for the most Bible-bashing, snake-handling Christian to be a secularist. And, you know, in the American Constitution, you know, Jefferson and Adams,
well, of course, but
on the one side were deistic.
Of course, if you took those ideas and put them in the American context, then your definition of secularism would embrace two polarly opposite sides of a debate in America.
But it's not a core ideology.
It's not entirely useful. I mean, I'm happy to say I would go along entirely with the idea of a secular state. And America certainly is that, in having a separation of church and state. In fact, I would consider that to be highly desirable. But I'm very strongly opposed to the secularism that is on parade in, say, Western Europe, most notably Britain, at the moment, which is determined to shut religion and indeed religious people out of the public square on every possible issue.
Right.
Of course, most recently in Britain, to put up warning signs against any of their scientific research as somehow suspect when contributing to academic fora and so on, that they have to declare religious affiliations and all this kind of nonsense. It's part of the bullying to try and push religious people out of public square, out of public discussion.
I mean, and
that's
when
another matter entirely.
I mean, when it comes to the regimes which you would classify as having been secular, Mike, such as the Nazi regime. I mean, are you saying that it is their atheism, it is their secular beliefs that have worked themselves out in this violent way, that it is actually the atheism itself is to blame in some way for their policies and those kinds of things?
Well, yes. Religion is certainly not the motivating factor. In communism, anti-religion is one of the prime motivating factors, and in Nazism, it's simply irrelevant. Religion is something that has to be managed out on the side here. The common people who are still mostly, at least somewhat pious, need to be burbled along so that the Nazis can get what they want. I wouldn't say that atheism is actually a motivating factor for Nazis. It's kind of irrelevant.
Right. Okay. But essentially, if you're talking about who's done the most damage, you know, people with a religious motivation or people who have come from a secular or atheistic kind of place, as far as you're concerned, it clearly swings in the direction of those, you know.
Yes, although not on the. I mean, we've spent a lot of the discussion today talking about the Nazis and communists, and frankly, that is such an easy point for Christians and other religious spokesmen to make that in my book, Gods of War, I put in an early kind of caveat here. You know, this is too easy. If you simply stack up body counts, then clearly the secularists are far more guilty. However, of course, and then I make the secularists' argument for them, that the trouble is that 20th century wars were always going to be more bloody because they were using the tools of the Industrial Revolution for the dreadful business of killing people. Mm. And so people like me need to prove far more than, you know, secularists have killed far more people than religious people ever did. You need to look at the full sweep of history and what kind of things are going on in motivating conflicts across the ages.
Well,
and that's when I get down to, I suppose, what's my my more important observations, which is that religion under certain circumstances has been responsible for a lot of fighting in particular eras of history. And I identify three periods. One would have been the sort of the early and central Middle Ages. Another would have been the early modern period with the dreadful wars of religion. And the other is the present, particularly in the conflicts over Islam. But that's itself part of a wider global conflict in which secularism is trying to impose itself on the world and shut all religion indoors. And amazingly, some religions are resisting.
Well, we're going to maybe look into this further as we continue in a short moment here on the show. We're asking the question today, violent conflict, is religion bad for the world? And Ed Turner is our atheist in the studio with me on the phone, Mike Pearce, who is a professor of history at, now let me get this right,
Houghton College,
Father Christmas's College in New York. So we're going to continue in a short moment. Do hope you can stay with us through till 4 o'clock this afternoon here on Unbelievable.
Hello, welcome back to the programme. This is Unbelievable. Okay, if you're around next week between 2.30 and 4, do tune in for a special review of a debate that occurred this last week between John Lennox, a Christian, and Richard Dawkins. And do I need to mention that he's an atheist? It took place at Oxford University, and I managed to interview both of them and take the views of many people attending, both atheists and Christians. It's a fascinating thing, and it'll really give you a sense of what happened that evening at the Natural History Museum in Oxford. Do recommend you tune into that between 2.30 and 4 o'clock next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And this afternoon we're talking about violent conflict and is religion bad for the world? That's what certain writers have been claiming. If you like, we've had a much more balanced kind of view in terms of our guests here on the programme today than you might find in other more polemical works. If you've ever read The God Delusion or God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens, you'll know what I'm talking about when those particular authors say that religion has been a cancer on the world. It's done far more harm than good. Just look at all the religious conflicts that exist around the world. It's a divisive factor. But essentially, you know, as much as we need to maybe apply a bit more of a historical scalpel to some of these claims, you do broadly, I think, agree with that, Ed, as our atheist today. You're saying ultimately religion is essentially something that is always going to cause conflict because it's my view, it trumps your view, basically, and you actually have pulled out a particular verse from the Gospel of Matthew as kind of representing that for you.
Yeah, I think religion, you know, is innately can be innately violent, and you know, and I don't agree that there's anything optional about religion at all. There's no freedom in religion, and yeah, there's a passage in Matthew 10, verse 34, probably something that you weren't read out in Sunday school, wasn't read to you in Sunday school or RE lessons, where Jesus explains to his disciples the cause of what his new cult, his new religion will have on the world. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. And you know that's you only have to look at the subsequent 2,000 years of Christian history, where it has been incredibly divisive. If it hasn't been an explicit cause of world conflict, then it's been an enormously divisive factor. I mean, just take the recent troubles in Northern Ireland. Obviously, very complicated situation. I would never argue that it was exclusively a religious conflict. A lot of social and economic reasons behind that. A lot of historical animosity. But at the end of the day, we had people being murdered for being a member of the wrong confession, and we had grown adults out in the street screaming, throwing stones at school children, not unionist school children or loyalist school children or Republican school children, Catholic children, Protestant children, on their way to schools segregated by religion.
Okay, Mike, I mean, this is something that I think a lot of people feel with Ed, because very often things like Northern Ireland are painted in religious terms, and that seems to be the kind of the language that's being used. But I mean, firstly, maybe respond to that statement from Matthew. Do you feel
concerning the Matthew statement, I mean, there's a reason that it wasn't read out in Sunday school and doesn't get read out in Sunday school, because it is one of the more, and I'm sure he will have his own reasons to laugh here, more difficult verses in Scripture, by which, of course, I mean that Christians have generally been troubled by it and wanting to explain it in a way that fits in with the rest of the pattern of go into the possible exegesis of that, and that perhaps he would be a little sceptical. But nevertheless, the reason it doesn't get read out in Sunday school is because most Christians have responded to it in that way. That is the central idea of the Gospels, that Jesus didn't come to establish his kingdom by force of arms. If I were, my servants would be fighting, he says, just before he starts to be, before he's to be crucified. His kingdom is not of this world. And that has been the central message as it was understood at the time, during the following centuries, and almost universally so, with the notorious exceptions like Northern Ireland apart, occasionally, in the present. Now, that doesn't mean that when Christians have behaved very badly across the centuries, as they have, that some of them will have resorted to texts like this and understood them in non-standard ways in order to legitimize religiously motivated violence. But conflict, in a sense, has already come about, that religion gets brought in to fuel conflicts that are already existing about something else. Now, if you look at the pattern of religious behavior and conflict, both in recent times and across history, it tends to be that conflict heightens religiosity rather than heightening religiosity fueling conflict.
Right, so it works the other way around. I mean,
you can see that very, very clearly in the Balkans, in pretty much all of the communities involved, and again in Northern Ireland. Now, it's not declining religiosity that has fueled the peace process in Northern Ireland. It's the decline in the conflict that has led to the growing secularisation of Northern Ireland. It's the other way around.
I mean, and as far as Ed's bringing up this particular phrase of a gospel, I mean, do you feel that it's unfair to sort of take it out of context and, you know, when as you say, the rest of the pattern of the gospel is a non-violent...
Well, I don't expect everybody else or anybody else to go along with my interpretation of the scriptures. I simply am making the historian's observation that is how the vast majority of Christians have understood it the vast majority of time. Frankly, I find that those kinds of explanations of it persuasive as well, but that's my own affair. But as we're having a discussion here about the relationship between religion and violence, then I think all parties really need to accept that violent understandings of texts like that are exactly what they are. They're exceptional, and they were not accepted by Christians in the first centuries, most Christians now, or indeed through the history of the Church.
Do you accept that, Ed? Your interpretation here is actually at odds with the vast majority of Christians who wouldn't kind of use this as a reason to therefore go around using the sword.
Yeah,
You had to dig for that, didn't you?
sorry, dig for what?
For a verse like that, say, in the Gospels.
Well, I wasn't read that out in scripture classes. I first came across it in Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith. I mean, it just seems to be buried.
Exactly. And most Christians weren't aware of it.
And so most Christians aren't aware of it.
Violence by something they weren't aware of.
Well, the point is, I have never heard a decent, coherent, intelligible answer to that question. Well, how do you know which parts of the nice parts of the Bible to follow? And I don't think I ever will. I mean, you know, biblical scholars and theologians do this amazing display of logical acrobatics, where it's like, yeah, well, you know, the Bible may, you know, there are those passages seemingly on the surface, you know, mandate slavery and genocide and torture. But, you know, if you get into the nitty-gritty and, you know, you read it properly, you know, back to front, standing on your head, drinking a glass of water, then no, it doesn't say that at all. And how dare you even make the suggestion that it does? You know, the point is, yeah, I mean, I'm...
It's a long discussion, but it's certainly not the same discussion as the one we're having today, because clearly throughout all of history, the vast majority of Christians have not understood the teachings of Jesus in the Gospels as being a mandate for violence.
Because I think they've used their ordinary, innate human reason to ignore those passages. And you know, basically, I think the Bible... You know, we can get it to say what we want it to say, and there are these passages, and despots and tyrants from the year zero up until Hitler have used the Bible as a motivating as a motivation, you know, for people to do the most unspeakably wicked acts, where otherwise maybe they would think twice about it.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, they were on common ground, I think. The Bible can be misused in myriads of ways, some of them merely odd and some of them absolutely atrocious. But, I mean, that's not really very contentious. I think that'd be admitted on all hands.
Right, okay, but I don't see why we need it at all then. I think the human morality predates scripture.
Really?
It doesn't. Does it predate
religion as a phenomenon? I think that's extremely doubtful.
Well, but the point is, we ignore 9/10 of the Bible today. And why?
Who's the we in this sentence here?
Oh, sorry. Well, Christians, atheists alike. I mean, but my point is, I'm not saying. Yeah, I accept that that not all Muslims are Al Qaeda, not all Christians are talking madder. At the end of the day, we are looking at extremist fringes. Using this stuff to motivate the population as a whole. But the point is,
if religions cease to exist, right? Do you think the causes for human conflict would thereby be eliminated or even diminished?
I mean, yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Really? But,
yeah.
Sorry,
let's
something very rude there. That's a laughable idea.
well, let's take the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East. I mean, they're fighting over. The Palestinians and the Israelis are fighting over a strip of desert on the Mediterranean, okay, which it was Golda Meir, the former Israeli prime minister in the 1970s, said it was the one spot in the Middle East that didn't have any oil under it. Okay, now you can argue and say, oh, well, they're fighting over land, they're fighting over that bit of land because they believe that the creator of the universe promised it to them and that one of their prophets, delivered it to them. I mean, I've got a brilliant idea. Why don't we just give the Israelis British Columbia? The Canadians aren't going to attack them.
Yeah, that's true. But, of course, the Jews have been unlikely to accept it, wouldn't they?
Because they've been promised it by God.
The conclusion of the Second World War would have been, if not the eradication of the Jews, then the eradication of Judaism as such, and that would have removed the causes for the present-day Middle East conflict. Because if so, I think secularists ought to come out and say so, having worn the sort of anti-Semitism hat one minute, and then switched around at the next moment. But, I mean, leave that on one side, the majority of Jews settling in Palestine were actually secular, and original Zionism was strongly, strongly disapproved of by the rabbinic authorities in early 20th century Europe. Now, the country itself remained secular, a creation of modern political and nationalist forces, with Jews understanding themselves as a cultural and indeed as an ethnic entity. Now, the religious arguments become more powerful as the years have gone on, as the conflict has strengthened. It's another illustration of the kind of process we noticed before. And as the conflict has gone on, so Islamism has strengthened on the Arab side. Arab nationalism was tried out first. It didn't really work outside of a Western context. Nasser and Saddam Hussein and Assad and so on. And Islamism has proved far more potent in modern times. It's another illustration of religiosity being heightened by conflict rather than generating it. I've heard a few more ridiculous arguments in this case, the Israeli side of the debate, than to say that the problem is Islamist radicalism, that if you can eradicate that, then somehow Israel can achieve peace with its neighbours. That's nonsense.
We're just going to take a very quick break to say that if you're listening to the programme and you want to respond to anything you hear today, you can do that by emailing me at unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And I'm very happy to pass on your comments and questions to our guests as well. You can also phone in your comments, and I know that our audience will have been interested in so much of what we've been saying. I mean, the problem is that religion does... Inevitably, religious views do differ, and things like the state of Israel, etc., is one of those big dividing issues. But if you'd like to comment on this, you're welcome to phone 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Leave me a voicemail message there, and I'll gladly play out your comments next week.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Coming back to you, gentlemen, I mean, your contention then, Mike, is that while Ed may be able to draw up examples of you know, issues that divide people of different religions or even, you know, Protestants and Catholics, etc., ultimately, this stuff is there anyway. It's human nature rather than the religion thing. And the religion is something that's kind of usually brought in more so once a conflict is already been established and is used then as a kind of to shore up their argument.
I'm strongly just now, but I don't want to overplay the hand there. That is the case far more often than there will be some cases where religion has been, you know, in there at the beginning, and that's the thing that's cranking everything up. But far more numerous are the cases that I've touched upon here in the Middle East and the Balkans and indeed Northern Ireland would all come into that category.
Okay. Ed, do you ultimately feel, though, that you stand by that claim, which Mike said he found patently ridiculous, that we would be better off without religion, that we would have less conflict in the world without religion? Do you honestly believe that?
I think if the Middle Eastern conflict was purely a political conflict, it would have been settled long ago. The religious element has, you know, made it a million times worse. And this just goes against the whole claim of religion that it is a force for peace. But I mean, just the general claim here is people say, oh, well, it's extremist Islam that's the problem. You know, it's fundamentalist Islam, you know, that is making this situation worse. It's the whole ideology is flawed. You know, Islam is about jihad. You know, if you read the Quran, its message is to, you know, subjugate, convert, or kill the infidel. But just imagine if we had, you know, a religion. What happens when other people of other religions start despairing? What about Jainism? I mean, the fundamental precepts of Jainism is non-violence. I think the world could do with an outbreak of fundamentalist Jainism. We may all starve to death because they don't believe in killing insects or being able to use pesticides. You know, the role that fundamentalist Islam and Zionistic Judaism has played in the Middle East conflict has meant that it's escalated and it's insoluble.
I mean, from that point of view, then, even if you're right, perhaps, Mike, that, you know, that these religious factors weren't as much of an issue at the start as they are now. I mean, nonetheless, Ed says it still made it worse. It's, you know, we'd be better off if those religious factors hadn't been there, that people hadn't had these texts in the first place to be able to argue over, you know.
Yes, yeah. Well, I'm not sure that, yes. I accept that to a point. I do think that the sort of intractable religious elements on both sides, well, for the sake of simplification, let's say both sides in the Middle East are making the situation worse, making it extremely difficult. I accept, too, the point he makes about the general nature of Islam. This is going to be a very, very difficult problem, I should say, for non-Muslims in the West of all kinds, as the West is increasingly Islamized during the 21st century, which is a demographic certainty. Because on the one hand, all of us, whether we're Christians or whether we're Western-style secularists, are fairly clear in our own minds that Islam has far fewer compunctions about the use of violence than Christianity, or indeed than most other religions or cultures. And yet diplomacy requires us to say the opposite, because, of course, we wish most Muslims to act in patterns that are similar to those of the best. That is, people who will integrate well, who will act peacefully, and we hope that they will. And that requires everybody to, as it were, say one thing and think another. And it's going to make public life in Western countries during the coming decades jolly interesting, to say the least.
Just your sort of point about, I agree with you, Islam is behind the rest of the world. It's because Islam has not gone through the same process of secularization that the Western world, you know, went through, you know, from the 16th century onwards. You know, when people say, that you know, they sort of scorn at this idea of say Richard Dawkins' idea of a changing moral zeitgeist as just we're not pious enough, we're not holy enough. What I say is, well, would you like to go back to a millennium earlier when, you know, religion governed everything, when people were explicitly superstitious, when your son, your daughters could be stoned to death or burnt at the stake for giving someone the evil eye? So it's basically, Islam is behind the Western world because it hasn't gone through the same process of secularization that the Western world has. I think the Arab world, one statistic I've heard is, I think the Arab world has translated less external, foreign literature into Arabic since the 9th century than Spain translates in a year. In a year. Now, that is a serious problem. The Middle East are still theocracies.
The trouble is, you see, that they're not theocracies. I say that's not the trouble. I don't want them to be theocracies. What I mean is that if you look at most of the actual violence going on inside Muslim societies, they are generally Islamists attempting to bid for power. Only in one major society I can think of, Iran, have they actually succeeded in attaining power. And most of the disaffection that's felt towards governments, for example, in places like Egypt or Algeria, or even Saudi Arabia, for goodness sake, is that the Islamists are not in power. It's quite wrong to describe them as theocracies. They're profoundly religious societies in a way that you obviously don't like, and which I don't, for different reasons, don't like either, namely the compulsory nature.
We're going to have to draw things to a close, gentlemen, but it's been a fascinating discussion this afternoon.
It's been fun, actually. I'm going to have to go outside and have a long cigarette, I think.
ultimately, there were a lot of points of agreement, and because, Mike, you make the case, and I think most would agree with you, that Christianity shouldn't be sort of this kind of state idea. It was never intended to be that, and when it has been used as that, that's when it's had its worst periods of history, if you like, and the ones that Ed would probably most readily point to as being damning, if you like. But your contention is that, A, that it should never have been that way anyway, and B, in any case, we have to, as it were, look at all parts of the things that contribute to warfare that may on the surface have a kind of religious connotation, and indeed at regimes which have been explicitly atheistic. Could you both maybe just in a minute or so sum up where you feel we've got to in the course of the discussion? Maybe start with you, Ed, and then we'll have Mike conclude.
You're right. We do agree on most things, and I feel that the religion, state, and religion should be separate. I am a secularist. I don't have a problem at all with people believing in God or practicing religion. I just object when it's foisted upon me, and it is, it is used to legitimise the actions of the state. I feel that religion has been so harmful to, to political discourse, and that it needs to have a lid put on it, or maybe even cut off at the roots, and just to educate people as what they are really fighting about. At the end of the day, a religious war is as a wise man once said, a religious war is a fight over who's got the best imaginary friend. But I think it is a catalyst. I think it's divisive. I think it makes an already inflammatory situation, thermonuclear.
Okay, Mike, do you want to just wind up your thoughts?
Well, I'd first say that concerning the religious causes of individual conflicts, the question that probably needs to be asked is, if religion could be imagined out of situation X, whichever one we're looking at, the situation of conflict we're looking at, would that make the conflict disappear or go away? Really? If the answer to that is yes, then there's probably a pretty strong case against the religious parties involved. But if the answer is really no, that it's providing moral cover for something else, then we can't really say that religion has caused the conflict. As far as Ed's wish that people could be educated out of religion, he more or less has his wish already in, for example, the British school system, where schools for a long time now have shown what is ironically called equal respect for all religions, and we all know what that means. Religious people are obliged to pay their taxes to fund this, that the state takes their children away from the age of five and compulsorily secularizes them. And I find that actually rather objectionable. I don't think that, that there's any problem with the idea of a secular state. Actually, that's a jolly fine ideal. I do object to the constant and relentless campaign to shut religion in general and religious people in particular out of the public square and from bringing the moral insights that they can bring and which have upheld and continue to uphold such moral order as still exists in Western countries, if only as a kind of a debased inheritance from a time when far more people were religious. That moral order is what makes social life possible, and is the principal arbiter in the disputes between individuals and indeed even between nations, and holds our unhealthiest instincts, because I don't believe that people are naturally good and naturally moral, in check.
Well, thank you very much both for being on the programme today. Let me remind you, if you're listening and would like to get a copy of The Gods of War by Mike Pearce, which was something that did come up during the discussion today, it's available from InterVarsity Press. That's the publisher. You can find it in Christian bookshops. You can also find it on Amazon, and you can find it at the Premier shop as well, premier.org.uk/shop. Thank you for listening today. Don't forget, this will be available as a podcast very shortly. Go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable to listen back to it and to many other shows from the past. Thank you for being with us today on the programme. Thanks again to my guests. They were Ed Turner, our atheist in the studio, and Mike Pearce, our Christian, on the phone. And we are going to be doing a similar thing next week with a Christian and someone of another viewpoint. Let me tell you about that.
You're unbelievable.
Do tune in again, as we have a special interview with Richard Dawkins next week and John Lennox, a Christian professor. They were involved in a debate last week at Oxford University on whether science has disproved God. Fascinating stuff, and it's going to be a fascinating review of that debate and what the people who were in attendance thought of it. Do go online as well to check back online, because I'm going to be posting the Richard Dawkins interview in its entirety there soon as well. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Until next week, have a great week, and I'll see you soon.